You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Whittle College, the Essex University College specialising in animal and equine sciences, conservation, horticulture, veterinary nursing and physiotherapy, agriculture and floristry, among other things, was granted degree awarding powers of its own earlier this year. I'm joined by Principal Dr. Steve Waite at the college's campus near Chelmsford. Dr. Waite, degrees here at Whittle used to be validated by the University of Essex. It seemed to work pretty well, but what does this change mean for Whittle, and why was it something that you were keen to pursue?
The relationship with Essex has been very useful. The university has always been very, very supportive of the college, which is excellent, but ultimately, it's a sign of our maturity. We wish to have more autonomy, and if you stop and think about it, if you look at the range of subjects that we offer, they're all very vocational, they're all tied into the lab-based industries, and you know, if you compare that with the mission and the direction of the University of Essex degrees, they are very, very different. Mm. So it's always a bit strange when you've got this relationship where you're having to go to validation and program approval with an institution that actually doesn't really have the expertise in your own subject area. So that was part of it. It's about getting our autonomy, being able to kind of direct and develop our own degrees in a way which will meet the needs of the industries that we actually work with and know enough about, well, not more than enough, but actually have those kind of contacts so we can kind of meet those requirements. So that's the primarily driver for it, is about getting that autonomy and being able to kind of be masters of our own direction.
And how long did it take? How long does the process from...
The process takes a long time. It's the best part of 2 years. Mm. I mean, effectively, you put together a submission which to the QAA, which outlines, basically shows that you have processes in place which are able to guarantee the academic standards of the degrees that you're offering, and that you can monitor them and make sure that those are maintained and you enhance the student experience, etc., etc., and that you meet all the quality code requirements, and you have the mechanisms in place to do that. So you produce a large document which kind of documents that evidence. That's then vetted, and then you have the processes about a year when you will have a scrutiny panel for the QAA, which will attend a number of meetings, and they will be here throughout that year. Not on a day-to-day basis, but I forget how many meetings. I think we had over 60 engagements where they will be sat in the committees and just kind of note-taking and seeing how we were working the processes. And then they'd also go through all of the paperwork, make sure the committee minutes are consistent, etc. You've got appropriate infrastructure to deal with those issues. So it's a fairly long, it's a long process, that's for sure, and thorough.
And what does it mean for the institution in terms of things like staffing? I mean, the partnership with Essex, is that comes to an end, and then do you have to bring
it? It'll be phased out. I mean, because students will move. I think that the plan at the moment is that we would have our first intake of students with the University of University of Whittle. We have a separate application for university title, which I'll talk a little bit about in a minute. But they would come with a Whittle College, whatever that are title qualifications. They would be enrolled in 2017, graduate in 2020. Mm. So there's a kind of phased reduction of those students who are actually on the University of Essex and those which will be on under our own degree awarding powers. But the relationship with Essex will still be maintained because we're not pursuing at the moment research degree awarding powers. And we do have a reasonable number for an institution this size, which is about the size of a small university faculty in some ways. We have over 30 research students, and those are all involved with the University of Essex research degrees, so either MRESs or PhDs, and they will continue. So that relationship for the research degrees will be maintained with the University of Essex, and they're very happy to do that. For the foreseeable future, yeah, that's right.
And a slip of the tongue there maybe revealed sort of the answer to my next question. I mean, the ultimate aim is to become the University of Whittle, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I mean, actually, probably the ultimate aim is that we're going through a consultation process would be, my own personal view would be that we would probably want to retain the college element of it. So it would be, say, Whittle University College or University College Whittle are the obvious titles that we would like to pursue. Because we have an FE contingent, the college, I think, is quite an important tag still to have. The problem for us at the moment is that BIS are no longer accepting applications for university title status. They're in abeyance at the moment while they look to sort out the guidance about what's required to get a university title. It's not a direct TDAP university title. It's TDAP and then a separate application for university title. And that's an interesting thing, because the thing that's driven that, my own personal view, is I think it's some of the consequences of encouraging private providers into the sector and how you deal with giving university title to those. The guidance is, as a result of that, there is a need, or we're told, to tighten up the guidance on that.
Yeah, it's an issue that we cover week in, week out at CHE. You mentioned there you do have a lot of FE students, yeah. You have HE students as well. I mean, how do you see yourself as an institution? You know, you hear the phrase HE and FE used a lot. Yeah. Are you a university college? Are you two separate institutions operating under one umbrella title?
For me personally, we're a single institution which happens to be a mixed economy institution. And I think that reflects the history of the kind of industries that we've actually served. So if you think about the history of RITL, it's over 125 years, or around 125 years, but it's part of a network of ex-agricultural colleges, although we do a lot more than agriculture. And those were established to meet the needs of the land-based industries, and those would have originally been largely in FE-type qualifications. As those industries have developed, as science has become more applied, and the technologies have become much more demanding, so there's been a natural progression for the development of HE, and who's going to provide that? Your specialist college that's got that history of developing those skills for the land-based industries, or some general FE college, or a university that's never had a farm or managed a farm. So it seems logical that that's how we've ended up in this current situation. I personally find no problems with it. I think it needs to be carefully managed. And I would also say that I think, David Willetts in the past and other ministers have celebrated the diversity of the British higher education system, the education system generally, but we're an example of it. So I don't have an issue with it.
And do you think institutions like RITL have been overlooked by ministers in the past?
I think overlooked maybe slightly too strong, but yes, in the sense that I think it's naive to believe that if you're slightly unusual, that the kind of regulations and procedures that develop in the sector as a whole are necessarily going to be beneficial to you, because clearly you're going to be aimed at dealing with the larger players in the sector. But I do think there are some interesting anomalies, in the sense that, for example, HEFGE has funded us in the past for capital equipment and capital build. We've not been successful recently, but I think that's true of many other institutions, because funding's no longer there. But it's always been, you have to make the case that the funding is for HE students. Now, unfortunately, the Skills Funding Agency and the Education Funding Agency's approach has been, actually, we don't and can't, because we're an HEI, apply for any funding at all for capital build to support our FE colleagues. So the end result of that is that over the last 15 years since we were incorporated as an HEI, we've been unable to pull in capital funding for 50% of my students. And that's a classic example of where, you know, you celebrate the diversity of the education system, but the actual way in which that system is constructed disadvantages those institutions that are slightly unusual.
That's a typical question, really, you can ask in any situation. Biggest strengths, biggest challenges. In this case, I guess, of being, you know, a smaller specialist institution, do you find you're, you know, in the shadow of some of the bigger HE players, while, you know, also competing with FE providers? And on the other side, how do you benefit from your unique position?
I think that I'd rephrase the question and say, how do our students benefit? Mm-hmm. What's really interesting is that if you look at the performance of students at smaller specialist colleges, they, in my view, outperform those in the larger institutions. And the evidence I would give for this is if you take things like, for example, the Guardian League table, what's really quite interesting about that is that they will rank the independent and small specialist colleges separately from the larger main table. Although the algorithm for the calculation of their overall Guardian weighted index, whatever they call it, is exactly the same. Now, within the smaller specialist ones, I think we were something like 18th out of 33. But the really interesting thing is, if you look at the scores that the smaller specialist colleges get, which are largely based on student satisfaction and their perception of the quality of education they're getting, they would sit well above the norm for the larger institutions. So, bizarrely, I think when I did the calculations, and I could be wrong about this, I think we came out as about 19th on the ranking. Now, if we're 19th and we're 18th in the smaller specialist things, institutions, and you've got another kind of large number to go in top as well. So I think the evidence seems to suggest that if you go to, if you've got a passion for a particular subject as a student, if you go to a smaller specialist institution, you're likely to have a much better experience and a more valuable experience than if you try and do that small specialist subject in a very large general university that's doing a massive different subject area. So that seems to be what's coming out of that. So I think we offer a really good experience to our students because we're small. Contrast the experience that I, as a lecturer in the main university sector, and also from my own personal experience from my daughters, the experience that they get in a large university where a large component of their education will be as a member in a large lecture auditorium with over 200 students is very different from the experience that a student here. The student here will know the tutor will know them personally. It's going to be small and intimate. I think that's definitely an advantage for the student. In terms of the kind of challenges, then yes, I mean, I think the funding patterns don't favour us. Because we're small and specialist, I've got a 220 hectare estate which we're running. So we've got a farm, we've got an equine facility, we've got research greenhouses, etc. That costs money. So maintaining those types of facilities in order to provide a good experience for the students is a challenge, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt. It would be a lot easier if we did other subject areas.
It probably brings us on to a question about fees to an extent. Yeah. I mean, it's often talked about the different prices of different courses. Some, maybe a history or an English course doesn't cost quite as much as a veterinary physiotherapy course where there's lots of specialist equipment involved. I mean, I've glanced at the fees here at Rittle. I mean, you are, like most in the HE sector, charging £9,000, typically, for undergraduates. There's nowhere to go, is there, really? I mean, that's the maximum amount you can charge. I mean, you've got a number of international students here. Is that your approach to getting more money in, or do you hope that maybe policies will change that will benefit you and allow you to get more cash?
I mean, how do you answer a question like that? I think there are a number of themes there. I mean, I think we, in the common with many other institutions, could not financially charge us in like £1,000. There's an interesting question from a student's perspective as well, is that there's not a lot of evidence that I'm aware of that students make decisions on fee levels significantly, so there's no real differentiation in the market in terms of that. Interesting. If you were allowed, as the Brown Report originally suggested, you had a fee bracket that went from 6k to 12k, then I think you probably might have some differentiation based on price. But that's a separate question. In terms of potential ways of generating new income, for us, the international market is important, but it's a very small market because the types of subject areas that we are trying to recruit to don't have a large, massive international market, particularly in the kind of Asian countries. So that's a challenge for us. Some areas where we do recruit quite well for, I mean, for example, we do BSc in professional floristry, and that recruits very well from South Korea and Japan because that's an accepted career in those countries. And for those programs, we would struggle without an international input. But for other programs, the internationals is an add-on rather than a kind of essential to maintaining them.
I wouldn't expect any different from any university or university college leader than to refer to the league tables in a way that puts Rittle as high up as possible. I think it's a fair point here because of the specialist nature. But
I think the point I'm making, I'm not for one moment saying, because the nature of the experience that you'll get at Rittle, what I'm saying is the nature of the experience that you get at Rittle is different from that in a large university, having worked on both sectors. And I think for some students, and in some subject areas, the experience that they get at Rittle is the appropriate one, and that's the one that they should do. So I would not, you know, I'm as you say, you'd expect me to make the best of the rankings, but I do generally believe that for some students, the type of experience you get in a small institution is much more appropriate for them, and they flourish in that environment.
The other league table I was going to move it on to is the research excellence framework. Yeah. Whittle entered, I believe it was for the first time, the 2014.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably fair to point out that in terms of grade point average, the institution came sort of at the bottom. There were no four-star submissions. I guess I just want to ask why you got into REF and whether you got out of it, what you wanted.
There were two things. I think it's an interesting question as to what we expected to get out of it. The decision to go into REF was made, and it provided, I think it's essentially a way of providing a baseline. The college actually believe, and I think it's no different to many other HE institutions, that staff should, as a matter of course, be engaged in scholarship and research. Mm. So it is useful to engage in a benchmarking exercise like this. And for us, we didn't do any higher than we had any expectations of, really, in a way. But if you take the agricultural and veterinary submission, I think it showed that over 70% of our outputs were of national and international significance. Only a very small percentage of the outputs weren't actually appropriate. I think it was less than 6% didn't count. So for an institution which is, as I say, it's really the size of a small university faculty, actually the output was pretty good for that. And there is a small but significant, for us, income stream which will result from that. So it's about kind of saying, okay, this is where we are at the moment. Let's get the benchmark and find out.
Mm. I mentioned the veterinary physiotherapy course earlier. It's an integrated master's course. So is it 4 years, I would guess? And that must mean students can access public funding for a master's level course, which is a good thing.
Yeah. And it's linked to, something else that we've tried to do, particularly in our HE provision, is to focus and pick up on this focus about employability. And one of the ways in which we've been tackling that is to make sure that all of our programmes are actually accredited or with the appropriate professional body. So it's that professional body which is saying, actually, you need a four-year qualification if you're going to come out and be a veterinary physiotherapy at the end of that programme. So that's why it's 4 years. And we're looking to make sure that all of our programmes have an appropriate kind of, if you like, link with the relevant accrediting and professional body. And the other thing that we're doing, moving towards, is to ensure that we embed wherever possible opportunities for students to get additional vocational qualifications. And those may be, for example, at level 2 and level 3, because what's really interesting about many elements of land-based industries is, yes, they definitely want somebody with a degree, but they also want somebody with a kind of level 2 or level 3 coaching certificate and a kind of first aid certificate and a crop spray certificate as well, because then the graduate or the person leaving is immediately fit for that role for industry. So that's something that the kind of added value that we're trying to build into our programmes.
So you must have to cultivate quite close relationships with industry.
Yeah, we do. Absolutely, we do. And that's the kind of key thing about being a small specialist and particularly employer-focused institution.
Mm. The degree awarding powers are on their way. We've spoken about some of the courses you've got at the moment, some of the funding challenges. What about the future? What does Whittle College or the University of Whittle or University College Whittle, what does it look like in 5 years' time, 10 years' time? What are you putting
in five years' time? What I would hope is that we've managed to kind of leverage opportunities for capital investment into the estate and then much more improved estate facilities. The estate is not bad, but it's kind of, again, no different to many other institutions. There was a big capital injection about 15 years ago, and we need to move up on that. So improved facilities for students would be a key thing. Marginally larger, I would like to see us grow about 5 to 10% across the board. Student numbers wise for both FE and HE. But the main thing is what I want to be is I want to be the, oh, it's not me, but the institution I would want it to be actually the leading regional institution and national institution for land-based industries. That's what you've got to aim for. And in order to get there, one of the kind of key things that I want the institution to become is essentially one of a kind of choice, both for kind of students but also for industry, and make sure we build up the kind of partnerships. But I do think there are other things that are much wider within the sector. One of the things which I think is unfortunate in comparison to where it was maybe 20 years ago is the sector doesn't cooperate as well with one another within individual institutions. And I think there are opportunities for institutions to work much more closely together in a more kind of collegiate way, rather than continually seeing individuals as competitors. And my point for that is I think there is a need to make sure the good practices spread. So things like kind of blended learning models, those types of things. Also for efficiencies, because it's quite clear the funding level is going to go down over the next 10, 15 years unless there's a massive opportunity to increase fee levels. So we've got to be much more efficient, and we've got to deliver a much more quality, a higher quality product across the sector. You're not going to do that if every individual institution decides it's going to go its own way. And for us as a small institution, it's a real problem. In the sense that if you're a very large institution, you can have your teaching and learning centre staffed with a professor and several other colleagues who just focus on how they're going to develop pedagogy and improve the delivery. If you're a small institution like ourselves, you don't have the overhead input, the additional cash to actually do that, so you've got to be really clever about it. And I think there are opportunities, and I would like to see that type of collegiate approach to improving the quality of education developed.
Dr. Steve Waite, Principal of Rittle College, thank you for your time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.